It is Saturday, May 15th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, geek news, and the second half, your questions and comments about technology. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridge the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed on Geek Speak during the program are not necessarily those of KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam. He's a slacker and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
We also have Al Luckow, a new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Hi, Lyle.
Hey, what's that?
It looks like a cell phone. I found it sitting on the counter at the studio reception desk. Pretty weird, huh?
It does look neat. Did you tell the Lost and Found about it?
Nah. I think I'm going to try to sell it.
Sell it? But it's not yours.
Hey, look,
there's an owner's name on it.
Right, hey, there. Hey, Al, how's it going? You found my cell phone. I got that in Europe.
Did you want to buy it, Lyle?
I don't know. It's pretty cool. How much are you selling for?
Hey, that's my cell phone.
I don't know. Say $5,000.
Ooh, that's pretty cool.
Okay,
it's
guys,
expensive, though.
Guys, enough is enough. Give it back, okay? My name's right on it.
Okay, I guess I could use it for like an interesting blog on my post or something on my website.
And actually, I took it apart, too, you know, to see how it works.
Cool.
Ah!
Obviously, we did this to illustrate what's happening with the Gizmodo iPhone incident. First off, Ben Jaffe's also with us. He's back from Europe. Welcome back.
Good day. Guten Tag.
Good day, isn't that?
I went to Australia.
On the way through.
I went to Brisbane, United Kingdom.
Oh, I see. All right. Thank you, Ben. Well, we'll get to your Europe story in just a second. But
indeed.
What's the iPhone prototype thing?
Okay. Well, for those of you out there who haven't really heard about this, which I think there's somebody in Alaska that's been in a submarine under the ice somewhere.
Yeah,
that hasn't heard about this. Yeah, there are three people involved: Gray Powell, who is the Apple engineer who lost the iPhone in a bar on his 21st birthday.
Can we say post Apple engineer? Do we know if he's been fired or not?
He hasn't been fired.
Oh, cool.
Brian Hogan, the guy who found the iPhone. Catherine Martinson, who is a friend of Hogan's, and Jason Chen, the Gizmodo reporter who purchased the phone from Hogan.
And this was like an iPhone prototype, right?
Yes. So we have these four people involved. The friend of Hogan, Catherine Martinson, said Hogan had offered it for sale to several publications and seemed indifferent to the plight of the Apple engineer who had lost the phone. She said they looked up the phone's owner on the internet and discovered he worked for Apple. Martinson told investigators that she and other friends tried to persuade Hogan to return the phone, but he replied, "Sucks for him. He lost his phone. Shouldn't have lost his phone." Hmm. The magazine has reported that it paid Hogan $5,000 in cash. Hogan later told admitted he received a total of $8,500 and showed Catherine a box of $100 bills. Ultimately, Catherine Martinson, contacted Apple after the Gizmodo story ran, saying she was afraid she might be implicated because Hogan had hooked up the prototype iPhone to her computer and they thought maybe she could trace it. Now, there's been a lot of controversy around this because once Apple was able to go after these people and they got the search warrant to find to go through Jason Chen, the guy who's the Gizmodo reporter, They'd got a search warrant to go through his house, and everybody's saying, "Oh, he's a reporter. He's got to be protected. All this kind of stuff. He's, you know, it's journalism and all this stuff." But really, no charges have been filed in the case. But the affidavit for the search warrant, which has just been released, says that he committed three felonies. Alleges he committed three felonies: buying or receiving stolen property, theft of a trade secret, and maliciously damaging property worth more than $400. That's the lowdown on
the phone was taken apart and probably damaged slightly during that taking apart.
Right. And, you know, so, Apple being, you know, as secretive as they are, everybody seeing the new iPhone like this is
there's more
damaging
in that sense. Right. A little trade secret issue.
Right.
So, and it comes down to, I get the journalism idea that, you know, you want to protect your journalism from sharing information. Mm-hmm. You should be able to do that.
Right.
But it's not just information. It's that he had property.
It was obvious whose it was. It was stolen. It was there was no doubt that you could find the person.
Okay, so here's the question. If you find something and it's laying around mm-hmm. somewhere in public space mm-hmm. and you pick that up and you put it in your pocket, is mm-hmm. that stealing?
Well, if it has somebody's name on it and it's not yours,
yeah.
I think that the proper thing to do is to look at the establishment you're in and look at the authority figure of that establishment.
Assuming it's a reputable store.
Right.
You know, you don't want to be in some sleazy place. Right. But I'm assuming that's a relatively trustworthy. That's what I would do. Like if I found an iPhone, for example, mm-hmm. I'd pick it up, take a peek at it, see if I could find out whose it was, which shouldn't be that hard. And then try to contact that person or even look on the most recent call list and like try to call the people that most recently called and say, hey, I found a phone. I think it might be somebody you know. Is it say, you know, are you on a cell phone? Do you know whose phone this is? Because it would have the callback thing.
I think that's
And then
reasonable.
Try to get it hooked up to that person. I wouldn't – the first thing I would probably do would do that. And then if I was in a hurry or something, I might give it to the establishment and deal with it that way. If I could get a hold of somebody right away, I might meet up with them.
And
that's kind of what I would do.
I don't think that's technically difficult either. And in this story –
looks like they even looked at who the employee was.
They describe Brian Hogan as a person who's technically proficient. And he indeed had actually taken apart the iPhone as well. So it's not like he didn't know how to maybe discover whose phone this was.
Right.
You know, I just hope if somebody finds my phone, they don't just take it and go sell it. You know, it's
Miles, you had something to say on this?
I was thinking from a journalistic standpoint, I can see the idea of like, oh, I have a scoop, but it wouldn't extend to taking the phone away and not trying to find the owner. It would be along the lines of like, oh my God, this is this new thing. Let me take out my phone, take a couple pictures of it. Oh, hey, here's the stuff. And then you hand it off. Like that.
Yeah.
That
and seems if I found like the next generation iPhone at a bar, I would definitely take pictures
that
of it.
Seems
I
like
back to
that seems like the journalistic angle. That seems like if you are a journalist, that's where you go. So beyond that, where you start
it's
confiscating
the, it's
property.
It's also the making money of it, and making money from the $8,000 sale.
Yeah.
That's stolen property. Once you put a figure on it and you sell it, especially, and that's, interesting.
Yeah. So that's the lowdown for all those guys that just got out of that submarine underneath the ice in Alaska.
That's what's happening. Okay, thanks. And that's what our skit was about. Okay, great. And Ben, you actually are here.
That was kind of me, the guy in the submarine. I wasn't following tech news when I was gone, and I have to say it was a little nice, kind of like being in this little
this bubble of Europe. What do you?
Yeah,
you
this
couldn't
bubble
think of the newspaper.
Bubble of Europe. They don't have computers there.
Well, I know their broadband's not as good as ours.
Oh God! Don't even get me started.
No, hey. Are you saying the CEO of Verizon is lying to you?
Actually, you were really quiet. Were
False
you,
dichotomy.
Were right? you online
He's lying
at all?
Or not. What?
Were you online at all?
I was actually online quite a bit. I was checking my email, mainly looking for things that I had to respond to right away. Mm-hmm. Other things I was just ignoring.
Hence the ignoring
of me. Oh, my gosh. So I had 128 emails in my inbox when I left the United States. When I came back, I didn't sort any of my mail. And not including GeekSpeak mail, the number of messages in my inbox was 654 when I got back. So I've got like 500 emails in 3 weeks.
It's busy.
It's scary, yeah. But
so what was Europe like? Do you have a good time?
Oh, it was fantastic.
So
actually, more to the point, when you got internet access, where'd you get it from and how much did it cost?
Always free, because I don't really ever want to pay for internet, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm
except at home.
pinching pennies, yeah. So I can buy good food instead
and
of buying
Europe.
Internet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Because the internet in Europe is the same as the internet here. You know, with food is not, and the
well, but is it? Miles kind of asking is
right.
Is it
where
fast?
Where
it
did
free?
You get it from? You're saying I didn't pay for it, so where did you get it from?
Mainly hostels. I actually found it strangely difficult to find internet cafes. Actually, like when I would get off a train and I'd be asking people, "Hey, do you know where an internet cafe is?" And most people would say, "Gee, I'd have no idea. Like, I don't know."
But do most cafes have internet for free?
No, no. Mm-hmm. Which made this more difficult. Many cafes, as they're called, are not cafes at all. They're places with menus that cost $22 for you know a
right. Cafe means restaurant.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
So that was a little bit difficult, but I did manage to find internet mainly in hostels that I found, and a couple internet cafes.
My assumption when you're saying that there wasn't a lot of internet cafes is that there's so much more broadband in cell phone use that if you had a cell phone, you had internet, and therefore you didn't need a place for it.
Well,
you could even toggle, you know, connect that to your computer. But that's just an assumption, Miles. Do you think that's probably accurate?
Well, I don't know. I that's why I was asking the question to see whether or not it was a situation where right now we don't have payphones on the street anymore, and it's not because everyone hates payphones; it's because everyone has a cell phone now. So,
well, I found
the
that
utility
most,
has been
most people yeah, do did
right,
have cell phones. Probably the same. I mean, I have a limited data set, but the same percentage I would imagine of people over here who have smartphones with with internet and everything, like iPhones or
Android phones. So some people had non-smartphones?
Had over there, yeah. Some people didn't have smartphones. Mm-hmm. Some people had them. Mm-hmm. But they also do have payphones. Like, you saw a lot of, like...
Especially in England, right? The big red box, you can't get rid of those.
Yeah, that's true. No. It's historical. But yeah, so I went
Doctor
to...
Doctor Who lives there.
How would he be a spy if they didn't have those?
Exactly. No, but I hit London, Copenhagen, Amsterdam, Mainz, which is near Frankfurt in Germany, and then a couple towns in Belgium, Ostende, Bruges, and Ghent. And all of those places were awesome.
How many people did you have more than 5-minute conversations with?
Oh,
did you keep that list going?
Actually, okay, so yeah, you wrote on my face. So for people who haven't been following.
I updated it on the show like a couple weeks ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I actually posted a comment.
All right.
A comment last night to that finished the tally. So I don't know exactly how many people, probably 40, 45, 50 people.
We kind of assessed how many people Ben met by having at least 5-minute conversations and exchanging names. If he did that, that's how many people he met.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty good.
On this train, I met 2 people in this town.
Totally non-scientific, but what was the most friendly city?
Oh, geez. I would say probably Copenhagen. I was walking with the person. I did couch surfing, which is awesome. Anyone who is thinking about doing couch surfing, awesome, amazing. I would do it. But I was walking with the person I was couch surfing with to this jazz bar to play my clarinet.
Wait, first off, how did you get hooked up with that person?
Through couch surfing.
What's couch surfing? Is it a website?
Oh, so couch surfing is a website. Actually, you know what? Maybe we should try and get them on the show at some point. Because
I'll describe it quickly.
Awesome. But yeah, couch surfing is this website. You make a profile. If you can offer your couch for people to stay, then you make a profile and say, hey, I have a couch that's available.
So you use that?
Yeah, and then if you're a traveler, you can say, hey, I need a couch, and search for people. And, I mean, the number one thing is no one's under any obligation to say yes, right? So only if everyone feels comfortable about their profile, the messages exchange, and everything like that. But I was completely floored at the hospitality and courtesy and kindness and generosity of all the people I met. Maybe it's just because I had a huge backpack the size of a small child, and so everyone felt bad for me.
I was wondering where kids were. You took my kids to Europe.
Yeah, I took your kids to Europe. But yeah, it was just fantastic. But a couple quick things I noticed, actually. Maybe I'll do my second story. Maybe I'll touch on a little bit more of this. But one thing that I found incredible is it's amazing the intuitions that you build and how quickly you adapt to certain things. For example, the streets, when I got into Heathrow in London. And I took a bus, and it was confusing because everyone was driving on the wrong side of the road. And I got to the hostel, and I crashed because I got in the evening. And I woke up in the morning. I got all ready. I'm like, yes, I'm going to go visit Europe, and I'm here. Finally, I'm here. I geared up, and I opened up the hostel door, and the very first thing I saw were 2 cars speeding towards each other on the wrong side of the road, and my brain exploded because it's just I did not get used to it at all. Like, I started looking the correct direction, but then second-guessing myself and wondering if I was looking the wrong direction. So then I'd look to the wrong direction thinking I was looking the right direction.
I'm glad you made it. It sounded like you almost died.
You just have to look both ways.
It happens to tourists all the time. I almost got creamed in Manchester, England, a few years ago. I mean, seriously, I and my boss almost died. We were crossing the street, and the car came between us.
Oh.
It came right behind him, right in front of me, literally inches separating the wind going by.
Well, I almost got creamed by a bicycle when
what? I love this story, but it's just not geeky enough. We have to move on.
Sorry.
Okay. Got any more geek stuff from Europe?
I've got the public transit was very cool.
Should I go for now? Yeah, it's got to be geeky.
All right, it's geeky. Public transit was awesome. A couple things that I noticed that are different from the public transit that I've experienced here in the States. In Ghent, they had these trams which made really sharp turns by at least U.S. standards. The tram was probably the length of your standard 2-car tram, but it bisected into 4 pieces, so it could make very sharp turns in these streets. In Amsterdam, this was, I think, one of the coolest things. It's so simple, but I'd never thought of it. They have these street-level trams which have 2 tracks, one going each way on the road, right? Mm-hmm. So they'd go one way on this one set of on this one track, and then on the other track they would go the other way. But between the stations, between the stops, the tracks would actually collapse together. But it wasn't like a normal interchange thing where like the tracks come together into actually one track. They would overlay on each other. Like the closest I can think of to explain it is like if you're in Photoshop and you have 2 pictures of a railroad track and you kind of move them they're overlaying themselves, but a little bit offset. So it's actually 2 separate tracks. They're just overlaid on each other entirely.
Why'd they do that?
So they take up only one lane.
Right.
Right? Instead of taking up two lanes.
Oh, but they're never actually going to be on the same tracks.
Yeah, they're never going to actually be on the same track. So the
sensors and all of that.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't have like the whole sensors to change which track you go onto and all of that nonsense, which becomes very complex when you have to worry about controlling that.
Right. You just have to make sure they're not sharing the same physical space.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of important with train
and it's
work.
All manually operated, as far as I can tell. Right. And then London has a fantastic public transit system.
Oh, it does. The tubes are great there.
Yeah, it's been burned into my mind. Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
All right. Well, thanks for the Europe update, Ben. I appreciate it. And welcome back. I'm glad you're here. I hope you're here next week as well.
Danku.
Miles, what's going on with Miles is going to talk a little bit about Amazon. Al's going to talk about DNA. Ben's going to talk about some Google news. Miles is going to talk about some IE9 stuff. And then Al, again, some more Google stuff. So that's what's happening. Coming up, Miles, Amazon.
Amazon is, right now, they have their Kindle product.
Which
is the physical book reader. There's also the software for the iPhone, the iPad, and also for the PC itself or a laptop.
You can do it on a computer, too. Okay.
And it's really convenient. I have it myself to be able to download books, and you don't have to go to the store and have a physical book. You can have it there. You can highlight. You can put notes on it.
Bookmarks, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it turns out that Amazon is... without telling their customers ahead of time, we're taking the highlights and the notes and taking a look at them.
You mean from analysis perspective?
Right.
Interesting.
So taking them in aggregate. Now, it doesn't have huge individual privacy implications because they are doing it in aggregate. They're posting information like, what are the most popular highlights? What are the most popular notes?
Right.
The things that happen most commonly.
It's valuable information, though, for them to get.
Right. But they didn't ask permission for it.
Mm.
So there's the question of how much comes from utility and even something that we would agree to, but at the same time saying, wait a second, if I buy a book, buy a physical book, and I put a highlighter to it and I put my notes in the margin, does the original publisher have the right to go say, hey, can I take a look at that book? I want to see where you've
Yeah, no, of course not.
Highlighted.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, the reason, of course, that they have that data in some set is that if something happens to your Kindle or something like that, it actually is attached to your account, so that information stays with your book. You know, you get your book back again, and the highlights are there. That kind of always backup feature of digital stuff that we like.
Great. And
so it makes sense that they'd actually have a copy of it. Mm-hmm. But that they use the copy, then again, from their perspective, I can see it. Well, we have all this data. We're not going to use the private information about it. We're just going to use it aggregate, so it's not going to interrupt people's privacy. But they are taking a value... They're using a value that is actually owned by the individual.
Well, more to the point, they didn't tell anyone.
Right.
Like it's kind of like that Facebook thing of someone gets opted in to having Microsoft, Pandora, and Yelp have access to them and their friends and all of that. It wasn't so much that being a bad thing in and of itself. I think for a site like Pandora or Yelp, it makes sense. But people still need to be aware that it's happening. People still need to be able to say, yes, I'm okay with this, so you can do this.
Just briefly, that story is about Facebook saying with Yelp, you know, we know who our account people are, and you know who you are, and if one of our people goes to your site, let's automatically authenticate them against it. So it's basically all of a sudden Yelp knows what your Facebook account is and attaches it to you without you saying anything.
Right.
That was a deal that Yelp and Facebook made without the consumer being involved. It's convenient. Yelp is a restaurant reviewing space, so you can go up and review restaurants and therefore get an idea of how good the food is in your area and how much things cost. It's really kind of cool social network thing. But to do that without any kind of input from the user is a very weird experience, like not appropriate in some ways.
Right. Especially because with regard to the Amazon Kindle, the idea was it was being marketed as something very simple. E-book reader, so it's just like a book. It's just like a book. You know, that's something that's hammered into it.
Except we can see what you do.
Right.
Does it also keep track of how much you read of it?
Yes, it does. That's for the feature of if you read a little bit, if you read a chapter on my iPhone, for example, then if I go to my computer, it'll
keep track of where you are.
It'll come up exactly the point that I left off.
So that means they could get that information too.
They do have that information, and a question of whether to use it to give feedback to publishers, saying this is how much of your book was read, and this is how many people actually finished the book. And
here's somebody.
Miles, is this information stored on the Kindle, like cached, and then uploaded, or is it just up in the cloud only?
It is up on the cloud only, to my knowledge. Or actually, it'll probably be on both. It'll be on both.
Because if you don't have access, then you'd lose your bookmark information.
I see.
Well, thank you very much, Miles, for that story. Robot update. We haven't done it in a long time, Al.
Yeah. DNA spider robots. These are
You need theme song for music.
I know.
Love your headlines. Yeah.
These are the smallest robots I have ever brought up on Geekspeak. What we're talking about is a molecular-level robot that can tool around inside the human body. It was these were originally created by this guy named Milan N. Stanovanik from Columbia University. The spider robot's made entirely out of DNA, but it's recently been improved from its initial version by a team of researchers from schools like Caltech, Columbia, Arizona State, and University of Michigan. It can now walk up to 100 nanometers unaided by using one of its biotin-labeled DNA legs to bind to and then cut itself from a trail of DNA breadcrumbs. So it's like, you know.
Okay, I'm sorry.
What year
is it?
I know.
They're making robots out of molecules.
It can go 100 nanometers, which doesn't seem like a lot, but up till now they couldn't even do anything. And these things, the thing about them, they can't be internally programmed due to their size constraint. The programming they receive must be external. So they kind of need
to kind of lay down a track of programming and information, and then it climbs it and does it.
Right. So
how RNA does with. I mean, it's very similar to the way the DNA and RNA molecules actually reproduce and make proteins. It's that same type of technology, if you will. It's strange to talk about it.
They have to respond to their environment.
Yeah.
And at this point, it can walk in a straight line, but that's about it. The next step is to get multiple robots working together with the goal of having drug-equipped nano-spiders working to eradicate cancer cells and other problematic cellular issues. So
that's amazing.
The fantastic journey is coming.
That's amazing. I didn't know that they were that far along with molecule robotics.
Yeah.
Wow. Is it called robotics at that point? I mean,
they call them DNA spider robots because they're... Because
why wouldn't you?
Nanobotics, maybe?
They're not what we consider the normal robot. They're organic, but hey, you know.
Hey, cool. All right. I bet they're man-made machines.
Yeah.
So they're robots, I guess.
Yep. All right.
Where do Borg nanoprobes fit into this?
That's sci-fi.
Yeah.
I see. And this is not sci-fi.
Yeah. Those are called Black Widow spider, brown recluse nano spiders.
What?
Brown recluse spiders are really poisonous spiders. Okay. All right. Anyway, let's move on. I feel like we just covered Ben, but I guess not. What's up with Google News?
Yo. I've got two quick mentions, actually. This won't be too long. But one is, hey, all you students out there, if you wanted to try Google Voice, but you were put off by the fact that you had to wait a month or two or 10 years for an invite when you sign up, now you can get it within 24 hours. So back in August, Google did the same kind of thing for Google Voice for active members of the U.S. military, so people with a .gov email address at whatever .gov. Now they're doing it for any .edu email addresses. So if you sign up...
Facebook started.
Mm-hmm.
Watch
yeah, exactly.
Out, careful.
I know. It could go viral.
Google Voice, very cool. I'll use it all the time.
Me too. Yeah, it's basically a way of, simply stated, it's a way of integrating your phone with your computer, right? So you can do things like read your voicemails, it'll transcribe them, or you can type texts to people with a full QWERTY keyboard instead of doing it on your little mobile device.
This is what I use it for. At work, I don't have any cell phone coverage, so if I want to send a text message to somebody, I go log into Google Voice, and I text them from there.
Yeah.
And, of course, I've got an actual phone number, which is Google Voice phone number, and then the other feature, of course, is that phone number is called, you can set up to where it's going to ring, and it tries ringing multiple locations to reach me. It's a pretty cool feature.
That's pretty. Yeah. It's pretty shocking, actually, I find.
Why is that?
You don't have cell phone service at where you work?
I know. And the building's called the Digital Arts Research Center.
I got a little bit of... last night when I was there, that's where we were near.
Well, you were at theater department. Yeah, it's different.
It's
there.
Right near where you work, though, right?
Right. Yeah.
And I had a little bit of cell
phone. It's fine there. I go outside. It's fine.
Oh, yeah. It's just that building.
It's just
you go. You go, a quarter mile in any direction,
like
and you've got
different
full...
Nodes.
You
there's got four full different nodes that I found in the building that's fine.
Huh.
One of them happens to be the bathroom, which is in the core of the building.
Excellent.
Really strange.
Yes.
So you go into one of the stalls and the phone works. I know because my phone rings. I'm like, what?
Well, it's a mostly metal building, so who knows? Yeah. The whole building becomes one big antenna.
It's basically like that. You've got these little nexus works that
wow.
function. But strange, the places you'd think have access don't,
huh.
like in the hallways and stuff. Anyway, outside the building
or next
works.
To the windows.
Mm. So I go outside a lot. I'm not even working right now.
Right.
My spine's broken. I'm running around a lot. What were we talking about?
We were talking about... We're talking about Google Voice.
If anyone's, so it's free to EDU people sign up automatically or quickly.
Cool. Quickly, within 24 hours. Anyone who is geeky, I think, should take a look at Google Voice.
Absolutely.
Especially when you start really thinking outside the box, like Skype, you can get Skype out or in Skype in, and it's like $5 a month or something like that. And you can integrate that with Google Voice, which is awesome. So you can make phone calls from your computer.
There's a free service that does the phone number connection thing, that does a Skype thing with your Google Voice, which is also off. Google bought it. I can't remember the name of it. You remember the name of it, Miles?
Mm-mm. And you can also get it for your iPhone. 5? Oh, wait. No, you can't because Apple denied their app.
Oh. Okay. Well,
you can
anyway.
Probably get it for your phone, right?
Yeah. I think. Wait, are you talking about Skype? For
Google Voice.
I use Google Voice for my phone. It's fantastic.
From your Android phone?
From my Android, yes, Android phone.
So receiving calls is free.
With Google Voice? No, it's free. The only thing that you would ever have to pay for is if you want to change your phone number with the existing account.
If you're going to call from it, it costs money.
You're talking about Skype.
No. Google Voice, you can make outgoing calls with this other service.
Mm-hmm.
You can.
Wait, are you talking about Gizmo 5 or something?
Yeah, Gizmo 5.
Yes, Gizmo 5.
Google Bot.
It's
private right now.
Yeah.
And I have a Gizmo 5
you
account.
You can't get
make an
a Gizmo.
Thing. No, but I do have a Gizmo 5
oh,
account.
I'm so pissed off.
One at a time. Don't talk over each other.
I learned about Gizmo 5 right after Google bought it and right after they closed down registrations. So the last, I don't know, how long has it been? A year or something?
Something like that. It's my early adapter thing. Because when I found out about the Gizmo 5, I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. I want to sign up for that. And I couldn't sign up. They wouldn't let it. And then I tried logging in, and it worked. I'm like, oh, I guess I already did that. I seem to create accounts really quickly. Yeah. That's why I have Lyle at Twitter and at Flickr.
Well, that's because, you're fast.
Enough of that, though. Let's go on. Because I've got to do this. I've got to say that you're listening to Geek Speak on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. And Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue, and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
Hello, folks. Al Luckow here. Welcome to Spam Time. This is where we here at GeekSpeak bring to light some of the wonderful and amazing offers currently being circulated in what we know as electronic mail. You may have experienced some of these perplexing and persistent offers yourself. Here are a few to tickle your temper. Recently, I received a notice from the Facebook team. The subject line was, "The Facebook team sent me a message on Facebook." Yes, that sounds like proper grammar. Everything looks right, but if you hover over the link, you will see that it goes to csseoefficienia.co.za. That doesn't sound like Facebook to me. In another one, I was flattered by the USA Society. The subject was, "Be recognized. Receive an official USA Honor Society certificate on us. Pending final approval, you will receive an official USA Honor Society certificate. Free! I'm so honored. And lastly, the trusty old major discounts on things you need. Online coupons. How could they have known that this is just what I was looking for? Next week, I'll see you on GeekSpeak Spam Time."
GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Conflict Resolution Center of Santa Cruz, representing talk about creating peace under stress by connecting with others. Rita Mary Johnson discusses being peace Friday, May 21st at First Congregational Church on High Street in Santa Cruz. More information at crcsantacruz.org. Miles, what's going on with Microsoft's Internet Explorer?
For years, we've been saying, stop using Internet Explorer. If you click on the big blue E, you're doing it wrong.
And we always recommend Firefox or Opera.
And Microsoft,
me too, I always do that.
Microsoft themselves has even started an ad campaign saying, you wouldn't drink 9-year-old milk. Why would you use a 9-year-old browser? Speaking of Internet Explorer 6. Because even Microsoft doesn't want you to use Internet Explorer 6. We are now on version Internet Explorer 8.
Which is what they're offering right now.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which is still, I mean, better than Internet Explorer 6, but has some issues. However,
so is leprosy.
Oh, no. actually, Internet Explorer 8, in all fairness, has made great strides with regard to security. Internet Explorer 9, however, which is on the way, although not yet released, is very interesting in that they have committed to CSS, and not just the existing CSS 2, but also CSS 3 and HTML5.
Cascading style sheets. Cascading style sheets allow the browser to be designed and styled in certain ways, which isn't part of the data. A really great part of the web.
Right. One of the things about CSS 3 is media queries. In other words, you can write one web page and then decide that it's going to be styled a certain way on a mobile phone and a different way on an iPad and a different way on a laptop.
Very important.
Very important.
And also different types versus if you're going to have it read to you or not, if it's going to be a non-screen-based version. Mm-hmm.
And it's going to get a lot faster. It still won't be as fast as the WebKit browsers.
Which Safari is built on.
Right.
And Chrome.
Although it probably will be about similar with Firefox, at least what early reports have shown with regard to early tech demos.
So they are embracing the most recent version of CSS 3.
Yes,
CSS,
and so I have
which
this,
is really good.
So I have this fear that we won't be able to say stop using Internet Explorer. We'll just have to say upgrade it because like I said, they've made some great strides with regard to security, and phishing actually is top notch.
Oh, good.
Anti-phishing technology.
This is the thing that Al just kind of covered in his story, that if you think you're going to a certain web page but you're not really going there, that's a phishing attack. The browser can actually detect that there's an issue here. And we'll go, this isn't right. And that's a very good feature of Firefox and Safari and Chrome do that.
A lot of times you just need to, you'll see the link and it'll be, it'll URL, it'll say facebook.com, and then you hover over it for a second and a little yellow box comes up and you see the actual URL and it's just like some bizarre, really long thing.
If those
thing
don't match, don't do it.
Right, yeah. And it's easy to be fooled by that, but just use that little hover technique, especially in email.
I've gotten to the point where I just don't click on email links. Nah. Unless it's a link that like has a code that is going to auto-log you in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I worry about telling people some nuance there because
it's hard.
For a lot of folks, a lot of people that call into GeekSpeak, we ask them, what browser are you using? And there's some dead air on the other side of people going, I have a PC. And so when you have that level of technical knowledge, it's really hard to be able to tell someone, okay, now do this thing.
Look at the URL. But, what's that?
Yeah, look at the URL when you put the mouse over the link and wait for the hover tooltip.
And wait for the root domain and see the domain above the root domain. And if the root... And if that matches, you're okay.
Right.
Also, I think some mail clients actually don't have the hover technique working properly.
I'd agree.
There is a spoofing technique.
Is that hover thing in mail work all the time? I didn't know.
It always works. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm.
It takes a second. I mean, you hover over. You got to wait.
Yeah. Copy and paste the link instead of clicking on it. Copy and paste it in your web browser.
See, once again, I think we're getting a little too technical.
You can't copy and paste the link if it's a word that's linked.
You got to right click.
Right.
And on a Mac, it's not. You can.
So Miles is saying, forget all of that.
Right.
Don't click on email.
It's too complex.
Miles' advice is probably the best.
Miles, you got it.
You win.
So the actual advice that I would give to folks out there, especially if you don't feel very comfortable with computers, is don't click on any links that come from people other than your friends. If you don't know who it is that sent you that link, just don't click on it. If it says it came from Facebook, fine. Type in facebook.com into your browser, but don't click on that link.
Okay, here's the problem with that. If you sign up for a new service or a feature, they're going to confirm your email. The only way they do that is to send you an email and you've got to click on a link.
Well, then
expecting it. So be expecting it or it's from a friend. And then also use a browser that goes, wait a second, this page looks a lot like PayPal, but it's not PayPal. I'm going to tell the user about this.
Right.
Which is the anti-phishing stuff.
Yeah, as it turns out, Internet Explorer, the most recent versions of it, not IE6.
Right.
Internet Explorer 8 does that very well.
Cool.
And is that available for Macs too, or is that just a PC browser?
No, it's just a PC browser.
Yeah, they killed it a little while back.
So they don't have Internet Explorer on the Mac at all anymore.
Not anymore.
Yeah. So the 9, CSS, phishing, security, anything else with IE9?
The team is actually being more transparent. Like, for example, one of the bugs with regard to the technology demo for IE9 is, dun-dun-dun, Gmail didn't work.
Interesting.
And so you think, like, oh, this is a conspiracy theory. But no, the Microsoft team has said, here's a screenshot, here's what's going on, we know about it, it's a bug, and we're going to fix it.
Cool, okay.
And so that is a very nice change.
A little more transparency is nice.
Yeah, and so we've been bad-mouthing Microsoft and their browser for a long time, but I want to give credit where credit's due.
All right. Thank you very much, Miles.
Yeah, hear, hear to that, actually.
What's that?
Hear,
hear
to
that?
I said hear, hear to that. Good. That's fantastic.
Ben, Atlantis?
Yes, Atlantis, the space shuttle.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Hang on a second. Just stay right there.
The space shuttle Atlantis told me that it's not my turn to talk.
There you go. It's Al, how's it going? What's going on with Google Street View?
Oh, yeah. That's just a quick thing then. You know, everybody knows these vans drive around taking pictures of street views and all that kind of stuff. And then when you click on the map, the Google map, then you can also see the house. And, you know, it's a 3D thing.
I don't know if everyone does know that.
Well,
that
Google's now they know because I just said it. Yeah.
Okay. Taking pictures. And it's kind of a cool feature.
It's neat.
Some
I think it's
have,
awesome.
Yeah. I mean, if you're looking for a business and you see on Google Maps and then you say, oh, it's got a street view and you can click on it and then see what the front of the business looks like, you don't even need to put the map down, right? Then you just drive there and see it. It's
I'm much
cool.
more likely to say, oh, I know where that is, you know, when I see it.
And we have covered stories of, like, people, you know, getting the license plates had to be blurred out.
Right.
And things like that.
All these sorts of things. Well, it turns out Google has been collecting Wi-Fi network data from its Street View cars as well. They actually, you know, want to survey public Wi-Fi spots that have no passwords. So when they drive around, they pick it up. They just survey this information.
Hmm.
Well, it turns out they've been collecting a lot of data, like a lot of payload data that is just being transferred at that. And they've been collecting. They've got this huge amount of data now that actually they're saying, you know, it was the German data protection authority, the DPA, found that the search company was collecting personal data about user behavior on any public hotspot. Well, Google says, you know, we were just doing this, trying to find survey information on SSID and MAC information from just regular Wi-Fi hotspots, you know, just finding out what speeds are and all that kind of stuff. Well, you know, they got a lot more than that. And Google's saying, well, we didn't really mean to get that. And it was just an accident. And it was just a piece of code that we'd put in our survey equipment in 2006.
A couple years ago, one of the students in my program had an art project where he took a Wi-Fi antenna and aimed it at the quad at Porter College, UCSC. And just there was an open Wi-Fi there. Mm-hmm. And he just accessed anybody that looked at him. He just collected all the images that were going over the Wi-Fi, mm-hmm. right, and just stacked it up. So he had this art piece, which was just a slideshow of all these random images. Most of it was ads, you know, because that's the most, a lot of ads,
right.
But little chunks of things that people were happening to view at Porter Quad.
So it would be like web page
if
somebody
images.
Views a web page.
Yeah, if you visit any page that has images, those images go through the Wi-Fi. That's actually not encrypted at all, and he just was grabbing it and showing it. And it was kind of to highlight security issues, right, to people make people aware. Google was doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But Google's data set, that's kind of scary because also in those packages are the IP addresses.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that they can look on their Google search engine to see IP addresses and associate it with an address.
Oh, it's directly to an address. I mean, but now they're saying, well, Google has since halted this code in their vehicles. And they've said they stopped collecting the Wi-Fi data altogether.
Okay.
And they've segregated the data it's collected, but it's still, unfortunately, all in Google's servers. So they want to delete the data as soon as they can, they say, but they're currently reaching out to regulators in the relevant countries about how to quickly dispose of the data. You know, it's so funny, you can't
get rid of data.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, when you have things on such a scale as Google does, I think that it is conceivable that it was actually an accident, right? Especially because also it was their own internal investigation which discovered this. And then they were like, hey, we just found out that we were doing this.
It was the German Data Protection Authority that alerted Google to what they were doing.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
Oh, I thought it was...
You know, it wasn't Google. No, they didn't. And they're saying...
Deciding to do that is pretty devious.
Yeah.
You have to really intentionally
do
that.
The thing is, to find a Wi-Fi hotspot, to make some correlation between the businesses, to grab the frame data...
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's their issue with getting rid of the data is not so much to wipe it all out because they don't want to wipe it all out. They want to sanitize it so that it doesn't have any individual information, so it doesn't have any.
But here's a perfect thing. If they're driving by and they found a coffee shop that has free or has a Wi-Fi point, they can put that on the map. Say, you know, this looks like this coffee shop has a Wi-Fi point. Mm-hmm. That's useful information.
Mm-hmm.
The coffee shop probably wants to advertise. Like, that's not necessarily a bad thing. And then whether it's an open Wi-Fi point or not an open Wi-Fi point, the problem is that by default, a lot of home network systems are open. Mm-hmm. People aren't even aware of it.
Right.
So, and then also on top of that, collecting other data, like the actual traffic data,
Right, that's the thing, though. Imagine that you are a network engineer. You're like, okay, just grab everything and
we'll
sift through
it
later.
I can see doing that.
That happens all the time, and it's fast and loose. And I'm sure that actually when it was uncovered, that the legal team went, whoa.
Wait, don't do that. Right.
And I do have to give Google props for the fact that they've been open and honest about it. They've publicized it and saying we're getting rid of all of this data in all the countries.
It is very honest of them to admit, too, that they have been doing this after they've been discovered by the German Data Protection Authority. I think that's very honorable.
There are a lot of other companies that say, like, okay, it was just in Germany, so just have it be in that news and don't cover it anywhere else.
Yeah. I think they wrote a blog post about it.
Yeah, it's interesting to talk about. All right, well, let's move on. What's going on in space?
Okay, so this...
we just talked about this.
The space shuttle Atlantis it left yesterday on its very last mission, which is kind of sad. I know, bittersweet. Especially because that was... it first lifted off a month before I was born. So it's been in service longer than I have.
When was that?
In a matter of speaking.
When was that?
You haven't been in any service for much less time than that.
I don't know. I'm not going to say the date because, anyone who's really interested can look it up. October 3rd, 1985.
oh, my God.
I know. It's crazy.
You were born in 1985?
Maybe.
Oh, my God.
What? Right, okay. People who were born in the 90s are graduating now. Scarier.
So I get a few things when I walk around Santa Cruz, people recognize my voice. You're Lyle from Geekspeak. I go, yeah. I'm like, wow, you're a lot older than I thought. Thank you. I'm actually 95. I don't know if people knew
that. To put a geeky angle on this, Ben is younger than the Macintosh.
Wow.
Yeah, rub it in, huh?
We should introduce him.
1984.
Ben Jaffe.
Bong. Anyway, so that's a quick mention. The space shuttle program is dying, sadly, at least for space geeks out there. I mean, there are good reasons to kill it, too. Like, it's old. It's really, really old. And all kinds of things are going wrong. It's old for a space shuttle program.
It's old for someone that was born in 85.
Okay, come on.
To
space.
And we do have other plans for ships.
But they're not coming soon enough.
Right.
I mean, we're probably going to see. Yeah, we're relying upon the Russians and we're relying upon private industry to do it.
Have you seen the video that Al mentioned last week?
Mm-mm.
You've got to watch the video. Last week's show, go up there and look at the space station video. It's just a fly through of the space station, live.
I saw that news story, but I didn't actually look at it.
But
one really cool thing I learned, actually, I was at the Science Museum, and they were saying that now that we're going up on Russian space programs, with Russian launch vehicles, we have to wear Russian spacesuits, which are drastically different than American spacesuits because the pieces just don't click together. I found that very interesting, kind of like looking at the differences between the spacesuits. So
yeah,
anyway.
Cool.
Little geeky
thing. So wait, we're about to be flooded with space suits, right?
Well, they've
can't
got
use
this,
them anymore.
It, like when you climb into a Russian spacesuit, instead of it being airtight entirely, you climb into this little bladder thing through this. It's crazy. It's like you climb in through the suit's stomach into this bladder, and then you like cinch it together, and that's your airtight seal. And then the actual thing is made of cloth. So like the helmet is soft on the back. Like you could itch your head with it.
That's cool.
It's neat,
It's more comfortable.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the update on Atlantis retiring.
Yeah, sadly.
Miles, let's talk about broadcast bandwidth and such.
Or broadband, yes.
Yeah. Not broadcast, that's right, broadband.
It was a curious thing. Back in the early 90s, early to mid 90s, you had the Clinton and Gore administration talking about the information superhighway and wanting to push America forward.
Sure.
Broadband at that point was being discussed as being 45 megabit.
Is that, fair? Give me some numbers. Like, is that a good number?
Well, one of the things that for DSL, when you purchase it right now, it's 1.5 megabit, 3 megabit.
So they're talking
megabit.
About serious bandwidth increase than from what we can get right now.
Right. Now, this is in the early 90s, early to mid-90s. So this is when the administration was first starting.
And there was a whole bunch of money that came out that said, hey, industry, let's do this.
Well, no, actually, they were going to do it as a government program, and industry came forward saying, no, don't be government. Private business can do this so much better.
Mm-hmm.
And so how will you fund that? Well, we'll just charge people fees for it, and we also have good profit centers. Like, for example, when you think of voicemail or call forwarding, these things that you pay $3 and $5 for on your bill,
They don't cost anything.
Right. Call forwarding right. costs less than a cent to right. implement.
So this extra money for these services that people would like, that's how the private sector was going to fund it.
Right. And looking at some estimates, one of them was we've spent about, since the early 90s, we spent about $2,000 per household to fund broadband. In other words, getting fiber optic to the home.
Right, because when you're talking about 45 megabit, you're talking about fiber optic. I mean, that's the way to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that many people with fiber optic.
You could do it with cable, but yeah, in general, what they were talking about was fiber optic. That's why they were saying, like, we're going to do this. We don't need government intervention. We're going to do this. And
how much money is that, $2,000 per home?
It's about $200 billion.
So more than $200 billion. They've already spent that?
Do you have fiber going to your house?
I don't. Did they spend the money? Wow.
And
$2,000 per home, that seems excessive. We were doing napkin...
Over the course of about 20 years.
We were doing network, you know, napkin sketching, you know, before the show, just kind of like a little calculation on napkin thing. And we were talking about, well, it kind of makes sense about $500 per home because you got to run a cable along the street, then you got to bisect, then you got to put about $100 worth of gear in the home and the run. You know, so we're kind of trying to... It's a hard number to come up with. The last little bit.
The fiber optic, when we talk about it, isn't necessarily the point between Los Angeles and Chicago.
Which they have done.
Right, which is, by and large, fiber.
Right.
Also. And just like... heavy trunk, but
and we I mean we have
but we're talking about the last 100 feet, the last mile,
the last mile is what we're talking about, yeah.
Right, fiber optic to the home,
right,
or also known as fiber to the curb.
When you talk about your local phone company's hub in the local town that you're in, that always defines whether you can get DSL or not, they have fiber optic to that location. That's already a high bandwidth location. So really you're just talking about from getting to, like, if you live in Ben Lomond, from downtown Ben Lomond to wherever your house is, that last mile. And that has not had fiber optic. I don't know. It might be a pilot program or something. So this is kind of a scandal if they've spent this much money and they haven't delivered, and the industry said, we'll do it better than government, and they failed.
Well, that's the thing, though. There isn't a scandal. Oh. People have a short memory about it and wanted to bring it up that back in the early 90s, there was a commitment to say in 2010, you should have a 45 megabit per second bidirectional downloading and uploading the same speed fiber optic service that offers 500 channels for and internet for about $50 a month.
We don't have that. It costs
So if you have DSL or cable modem, you're going it depends upon your service, but I don't know, you're going 1/10 the speed you should be going. No, I guess a quarter of the speed. You should be going 1/5 of the speed.
All right, well, thanks for that sad story on
and if broadband. You're still on dial-up, you should be really angry because you're going 1,000 times slower than what you should be going.
Is this lack of broadband the reason why marriages are failing?
Oh, yes, I'm sure. And it kills puppies.
Al, is it the reason why marriages are failing, that broadband isn't available?
I don't know. It could be because recently there was a study from UK-based BCS, the Chartered Institute for IT, and it analyzed 35,000 responses from the World Value Survey to make a case that broadband actually makes people happier. And it turns out that when they sorted through all of the things, that it really, really makes women happier.
Really?
Yeah. They say it's just because of the role it plays in modern communications. And they say that for some reason, women are much happier with broadband. So
not just everybody, but specifically.
Yes, they say. Well, everybody is their life is improved, but they said the ratings, the system that they use.
Of course, more accurate to say that the women that took the survey responded that broadband made them happier.
Yes,
more so than the men taking the same survey.
Right.
Who knows what the figures mean? But interesting. Yeah. I agree. I think broadband makes me happy. Right now, when I'm laying 20 hours a day in bed, if I didn't have broadband, I'd be pulling my hair out.
I don't know what could happen, what you would do.
I mean, what would you... I mean, how would I access YouTube?
I don't know.
Ben, YouTube?
YouTube, yeah. YouTube has now 3 privacy settings. Just a quick mention. They used to have public, which is anyone can search for it, anyone can view it.
When you upload a video?
When you upload a video onto YouTube, right? So your video is public entirely. They also had private, which is you you can enable only specific YouTube users to view your video.
Sure.
But that means that if you want to, let's say you film a wedding and you want all of your family members to be able to view it, but no one else, they all have to have YouTube accounts, which is never, ever going to happen. So there's now a third privacy setting. So if you make videos, put them up on YouTube, this is good to know. It's called unlisted, and that is anyone with a link to your video can view it. So but it won't go into the search results.
So then you just send the email with that link to people and they click on it.
Exactly.
It's okay to click on emails, right?
It's great.
Okay,
no,
that's kind
no,
of
no.
a cool feature, though.
Or you make a tiny URL with it and you say, right. hey, I mean, well, same problem. Never mind.
But in general, what you're saying is now you, with your whole family, friends of, you know, the wedding you went to, you can then send the email out to everybody saying, hey, here's that video I shot. And only those people see it and it doesn't get on Funny Home Videos because Uncle Carl fell in the pool.
Exactly. Right. So you can do you can do tinyurl.com/Joe's wedding or something like that, and make that URL, and then people can type it in manually, so they don't have to click on it in the email. Right. I don't know. Anyway, so good thing to know for any of us video producers out there.
All right. You know what? I'm going to jump over to last news story with Miles. What do you want to do? Air Force or telecoms?
Air Force.
All right. Go ahead.
Nice little change. We talk about military and collateral damage in that way, but rarely do we talk about the armed forces having being the collateral damage. In this case, it comes from PS3s, the PlayStation 3. They purchased hundreds of them in 2009, and we're going to go to thousands pretty soon to use as a supercomputer and cluster. The cell processors and the graphical processing units on these PS3s are amazing. And so price per watt and price for performance is astounding.
Because what we're talking about is the PlayStation is made to be really inexpensive because, of course, the company makes its profit on the games. And so they're really producing a really good high-quality hardware at the baseline cost that they possibly can. So companies go and say, let's buy these up and use them as a supercomputer. Okay.
Right. But unlike other consoles, the PS3 is still, I mean, still you wouldn't want to do this with Wii's per se. The PS3 is a lot more attractive in that way because it is a more powerful platform. That said, Sony said that they weren't going to support Linux on it anymore. And unfortunately, Linux is the platform that people have been making these supercomputing clusters on.
Right.
Which means that if there's, luckily this supercomputer is never hooked into the internet. But if they were, and they were hooked up to PlayStation Live, then all of their systems would get wiped out.
Oh, man.
It becomes a maintenance issue.
So it's kind of a problem. All right. Well, we'll see if they relent on that. I hope they do because it's being used really effectively for supercomputers. Thank you, Miles, for that. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. We thank the Puppet Master for its use. Coming up next is the USB of the week. Al, is it 1 minute long today?
Mm-hmm.
GeekSpeak on KOSB is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSB Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Al Luckow with GeekSpeak's Crazy USB Device of the Week. Sometimes, while sitting alone in one's studio, one's aura can become chilly. If you are one with this problem, you may enjoy experiencing the Japanese USB heated seat pad. Its creators claim it will enhance your blood circulation, improve your natural healing ability, and activate your metabolic reactions. Well, let's see. Simply plug into a USB port like this. Sit on your mat like this. And soon, you will be feeling waves of over 100 degree heat on your aura.
Tasty, too.
Ouch!
Come here, next is Car Talk. Car Talk on KOSP is made possible by a grant from the Holly Family Fund and the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County. We appreciate their support. And I appreciate the geeks today, Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, and Al Luckow. For GeekSpeak and for KOSP, I'm Lyle Trox. We'll see you next week.